Amen. Thank you, worship team. Beautiful songs, beautiful prayer. Let's bring the lights up. And I want to invite you to turn in your Bible to the end of Matthew 27 as we continue in our journey through the book of Matthew, really through the whole Old Testament. We just, by providence, have landed at these passion passages during this time of Lent and upcoming Holy Week. Is there any more light here? Why does it seem so dark to me? Does it seem dark in here? Oh, it's those lights that aren't on. My airplane lights aren't on. I can make do. Oh, that's better. Or I'm getting accustomed to the light. I don't know. Either way, that'll work. Matthew chapter 26, verse 57 through 68. We come to one of the most difficult, if not perhaps one of the ugliest passages in all of Matthew. It's very hard to even speak on this passage because it introduces us to actions that good religious folk like you and me do that you just have to absolutely be appalled by and ashamed of and wrestle with. Why is it that the best of the people in Jesus' time are doing what they do to Jesus? We left off last week with Judas betraying Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. It's about a 20-minute trek from the Garden of Gethsemane to Jerusalem, where Jesus will be crucified. And that 20-minute trek would be the path that Jesus trod in the night, accompanied by the armed temple guards and also by Judas, the betrayer. He's also accompanied, and we'll see this soon, by Peter, who's following in the shadows. He's hiding. He wants to see how all of this is going to play out. And so we have this group, the temple guards, Judas, Jesus, and in the shadows, Peter, making this 20-minute journey. They're passing by the ancient prophets' tombs, and they all have to recognize that. Then they'd go past Herod's glorious temple in the dead of night, and they'd finally arrive at the palatial estate of Caiaphas, the high priest, who was very well to do. He had been the high priest for quite a long time because he got along very well with Rome. And this is where Jesus lands. And we have a cast of characters that we begin with here in verse 57 that we want to note. So if you're there at verse 57, those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the teachers of the law and the elders assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance right up to the courtyard of the high priest. He entered and sat down with the guards to see the outcome, or in the Greek, to see how all of this would play out. So our main characters, if we're filming this, we have Caiaphas, the high priest, who again gets along great with Rome, and that's why Jesus is such a problem. You have the Sanhedrin, and they'll be called by name in verse 59, the chief priest and the whole Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is like our consistory. It is the Jewish ruling council, although it has authority over all of the religious functions of Jerusalem. They control the temple. They are the ones that have ultimate say on how worship will go, how the law will be practiced. They have as much authority as you can have in a religious body, as long as they don't overstep their authority and start to get in conflict with Pilate. So the procurator has ultimate authority, but they have authority with religious functions. It's 71 men, 71 elders. They are considered to be among the wisest and the most pious men in Jerusalem. That's why they're on this Sanhedrin. So we have Caiaphas. We have 71 men there with the Sanhedrin. We have Peter hiding in the shadows. And we're not told where Jesus was put, but it's most likely that he's held as a prisoner at this point. That he is most likely in a prison cell in a cold stone pit that's been carved out from a cistern, that he's been lowered in a hole while they figure out how they are going to deal with Jesus. And they need to do this during a meeting. So Caiaphas calls a very unconventional meeting, and you see it taking place in our opening verses. It's unconventional because a meeting of the Sanhedrin should take place at the temple. That's where they met, during the day. But this is taking place at night, not at the temple, but in Caiaphas's home. They also never met during religious feast, and it's Passover. Passover is happening as all of this goes on, and it's not time to have religious councils. And so they're bypassing all orthodoxy, meeting in the dead of night, meeting in secret in Caiaphas's home, meeting in the midst of a festival, because Caiaphas feels the need to have an urgent and secret meeting in order to deal with Jesus, because he's now in their possession. And Caiaphas has one motive, one goal. And it's clear in verse 59. The chief priest and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so they could put him to death. They only need the false evidence because the motive is to kill Jesus, to eliminate Jesus. He must be eliminated. He is that much of a problem to them. So they call together a kangaroo court. And you know what a kangaroo court is? It's a trial that really has very little behind it. There's not any good evidence, but you want to rush someone through with very little lack of evidence because the whole goal is to convict the person that you've got before you. That's why they're looking for evidence. Did you notice? They're looking for things, for false evidence, because they don't have any charges. They just have an arrested man, and they have him arrested, and they want to put him on trial, but they don't have any incriminating evidence. They don't have anything that would make him guilty of death. And so they're looking for some charge. They need some witnesses to come forward, which is to say, they want to put Jesus to death. They don't care if the witness is true. They just need two people to agree. If two people could agree with incriminating evidence that would demand the death penalty, then this could be rushed through. But verse 60, they did not find any, although many false witnesses came forward. So you can imagine Caiaphas. He knows the verdict he wants. I would imagine he's thinking in his head after a while, after hearing all these different accusations, why can't two idiots agree on the same story? I mean, why do we keep getting all these different stories? Can't two of you at least agree? Because he wants to keep the law. The law demands that every matter be settled upon the witness of two or three. So here's this deep concern to do lawfully this kangaroo court. And he needs two to agree. And so he's looking for that. No one seems to agree until finally two people at least pull together a story. Middle of verse 60, finally two came forward and declared, "This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" Which is interesting, because Jesus says things that almost sound like that, but he never says exactly that. So that we have something that Jesus has said, but it's been very, very distorted. He actually predicts not one stone will be left on the temple because of the judgments that are about to come upon it. But he never says he's the one that's going to destroy it. And in the Gospel of John, when he says he's going to build the temple in 3 days, you have to deal with the fact that even though he said he's going to destroy it, he also said he'll rebuild it. You know, is that worthy of death? And so you have something that sounds serious, but not serious enough to warrant the death penalty, which is why Caiaphas finally pulls out his last straw. In verse 62, the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, "Aren't you going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? Don't you have anything to say? Don't you want to defend yourself? Don't you want to add your words so that maybe we can, you know, twist your words in such a way that we can find something to incriminate you with? Don't you have something to say?" Verse 63, but Jesus remained silent. The commentators usually say Jesus does this because in the Old Testament Isaiah, we read of the suffering servant who suffers in silence. But it also could simply be that he sees this court has no authority. This trial is not just. There's nothing just about this. This is a silent protest over a system that is deeply flawed. Not because the system itself is bad, but because the people running the system are running it to preserve their own power out of fear. Not because, you know, the system is corrupt inherently. So Jesus refuses to act within this corrupt system, so that this is when the high priest really gets angry. Caiaphas says there in the middle of verse 63, the high priest said to him, "I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." You see, that's what he wants to get at. He's looking for Jesus to say very bluntly and candidly, "I am the Christ. So I charge you. By the name of God, under oath, answer." And Jesus answers. In verse 64, we read in the NIV, "Yes, it is as you say." Now, different versions translate this phrase differently because there's a bit of ambiguity. There's an evasiveness to this. It's not so much that he just flat out says, "Yes, it's as you've said." It really, in the Greek, is technically, "You have said so." Or, "You've said it yourself," which could be implying that you've just said it. You've just declared the orthodox statement, "Christ, the Son of the living God," which Peter says in Matthew 16, and Jesus says, you know, the Father has given you that statement. But it could also just simply mean this: yes, but not on your terms. Because what you mean by Messiah is not what I mean by Messiah. So I can't really flat out say, "Oh, of course I am," because we have fundamental disagreements over what we think Messiah means, which is highlighted by this very trial, by all that's going on here. And so Jesus says, "Yes, it is as you say," and then he comes out all barrels blazing. "But I say to all of you, in the future you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." And it's at this point that Jesus is quoting from the Old Testament, from the book of Daniel. Daniel the prophet in exile has a vision. And in that vision he sees four gigantic beasts which represent national powers. And national powers in Scripture are never presented in the way we speak of national powers. They are presented as ravenous beasts, as beasts that seek to oppress and bring down the people, because they are usually built in such a way that they don't encourage godliness and piety and generosity, but they encourage anything but. And so Daniel has this vision of a lion and a bear and leopards that are twisted and multi-headed, and then this great beast with 10 horns. And it's frightening. It's like a nightmare for Daniel. And in the midst of his vision and these frightening beasts, he then says, "I saw the Ancient of Days," which is his way of speaking of the eternal God. "And I see the Ancient of Days," and then we read in that very same chapter these words which Jesus is alluding to. Daniel says, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was given authority, glory, and power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed." So Jesus is saying, "Yes, it is as you say, but I'm telling you, you're going to see a day when the Son of Man comes on the cloud of heavens." And they know he is taking upon himself this role that Daniel has spoken of. He is saying that you're going to see me, the Son of Man, coming on the clouds of heaven, having all authority, being the one who triumphs in the end. Now, that's absolutely absurd when you think about our scene. He's a prisoner. He's in chains. He is anything but this glorious Son of Man coming on the clouds. And so when they hear this, all of a sudden the high priest in verse 65 tears his clothes and says, "He has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look now, you've heard the blasphemy." So the accusation is blasphemy. Blasphemy is when you mock or insult the name of God. You use it in a cursory way, in a way that is disrespectful. It is, according to the Torah, something that is punishable by death. It was important that you held the name of God in the highest esteem. Now, Jesus hasn't said anything blasphemous. He actually, when he says, "You'll see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One," he doesn't even use the name God, as Daniel does. He uses the name Mighty One to make sure that he's not saying anything that could be misconstrued. And yet for Caiaphas, he's done all he needs to do by making it clear that it seems like Jesus is saying he's Messiah. Now you do know this, it's not blasphemy to say you're Messiah. There were many people that claimed to be Messiah in Jesus' day. But because Jesus isn't the Messiah they want, this is going to be construed as blasphemy. So Caiaphas has what he wants, and he says, we don't need any more witnesses. Look at verse 65 with me again. He's spoken blasphemy. This kangaroo court is over. We don't need to try to collect together any more witnesses. Look now, you've heard the blasphemy. And then he tells all of his Sanhedrin partners, what do you think? So that now the accusation and the penalty will come from not just Caiaphas, but every single ruling elder in the room. And the answer is, he's worthy of death. He deserves to die. And at this point now, we can move Jesus from the religious authorities to the place where they can finally get this deed done to Pilate. Because they have no authority to put Jesus to death. But if they take Jesus to Pilate and say, this man claims to be Messiah, then they'll be able to say he is a rebel against Rome. See, for them, the problem is he's a deceiver, he's a false Messiah, he's an imposter. That's their real issue. Their issue is blasphemy. Rome doesn't care about blasphemy. Rome doesn't care about false messiahs or deceivers of the Jewish religion. But Rome certainly cares about keeping the peace. And you can practice your religion in Rome as long as it doesn't tread upon Roman rule. And the minute it's a threat to Roman rule, then it must be crushed. That's what crucifixion was for. Anyone who rebelled against Rome would find themselves on a Roman cross. So when they take Jesus to Rome, or when they take Jesus to Pilate, they're not going to say, Pilate, he claims to be a blasphemer, because that means nothing. They will say this, he said he's king of the Jews. Well, that's Herod's title. It's a political title. He says he's king of the Jews. We know you Romans. You're the ones that are king of the Jews. But he says he's king because he's claimed to be Christ. So at this point, it's where the scene, which is already ugly, really gets ugly. The trial disintegrates into a mob scene. They all say he's worthy of death in verse 67. Then they spit in his face and struck him with their fist. Others slapped him and said, prophesy to us, Christ, who hit you? So the court should be over. They've got what they need to be done. They've been so careful to do things with the appearance of the law. Two witnesses. Making sure they've done this in a way that fits their religious scruples. And yet when it comes to this point, you look at it and say, all religious scruples are gone. Even for the lowest expectation of religious, you know, life. They are taking this man and pummeling him and beating him. And you see the absolute contempt. You see what oftentimes happens when people have to slap people or push them around because they have to show that their decision is vindicated and they're right, and they have to hold the other in contempt and show the other's nothing more than a worm and doesn't deserve any kind of human treatment. So these gestures of contempt make it very clear that there's no guilt, there's no sense of shame. They think he deserves this abuse and they view themselves as superior to him. He's a deceiver. They're righteous. He's ungodly. They're godly. They're concerned about the things of God. And when Jesus takes it and he receives their beating, they have to come up with complex games to make it more interesting. So they blindfold him and say, hey, who hit you? Figure it out. You're the prophet. Boom! Which one hit you that time? And you see how ugly this gets. You almost are glad this isn't on a film before. You can only take one picture of it and then you think, you know, let's move on. Because these aren't rogues and scallions beating Jesus into submission out of contempt. These are religious folk. These are moral, God-fearing, law-keeping religious folk. And you realize what an ugly picture we have. Now, as we reflect on this, it's interesting to think about this, that Jesus in this particular trial, and there's a trial part two, which we'll look at on Sunday with Pilate, but trial part one is where the religious authorities condemn and reject Jesus. In trial part two, the political authorities through Pilate and the crowd representing everybody else will all reject Jesus. Crucify him, crucify him. Which is to say, the perennial answer to the question that always comes up around Easter time is, who killed Jesus? Well, everybody. The religious authorities, the political authorities, and the crowd. No one is exempt. Everyone is involved. Everyone's implicated. When people get concerned that we don't want to read these stories too much because it might be too anti-Semitic, and we always need to be careful that we don't just blame the Jews, because this is an intramural debate. Jesus is a Jew. Everyone here is a Jew. That's not the issue. The issue is not ethnicity. The issue for us as Christian readers is religiosity. That they, like us, are concerned for God. They, like us, are concerned for law. They, like us, are concerned for justice. They, like us, are concerned for holiness. And so what we see here is how religion can so derail things. Adam Hamilton's writing a book, wrote a book that Frank and the Christian Ed group are going through. It's 24 hours, the last 24 hours of Christ's life. They're going through the video series. I'm going through the book. And he has some wonderful things he says about this, but they're very incriminating. And if you feel like perhaps you're too much under the thumb here, realize these are the religious leaders. So guess who is number one person under the thumb of these quotes and this text? It's this guy. It's me. And if you're on consistory, it's you too. All right? We must not miss the... I need someone to scapegoat this to. he writes, "We must not miss the irony here. It was not the sinners who arrested God when he walked among us. Those who took him into custody and tried him were the most pious and religious people on the face of the earth. And yet they were so blinded by their love of power and their fear of losing it that they missed him. The people that you would most expect to recognize and hail Jesus instead arrested him in darkness and put him to trial." So that Hamilton goes on and says, here's the question we need to wrestle with, particularly religious leaders like myself. The question we're meant to ask, the question we must ask, is how could this happen? How could 71 righteous men dedicated to God do what these men did? Why did they condemn an innocent man to death? And then this is the tough one. And even if they thought he was a false Messiah, why would pious men, pillars of the community, spit on him? Why would they blindfold, mock, and strike him? And you realize the contempt and the hypocrisy and the violence justified in the name of their morality and their religion. And you begin to see how ugly a scene this is on display before us. And so in order to counter the ugliness, you also need to see something else, which is not so obvious, but it's what passion is all about. You need to see that in the midst of this ugly human behavior is an extent of divine love that cannot be calculated. The reason we call Jesus Passion the Passion is not first and foremost because he's passionate, because he's loving. We call it the Passion because it is the passive obedience of Christ. Which is to say, prior to the cross, we've seen his active obedience, his healings, his miracles, his compassion, his doing things for others, that he's actively engaged in doing the will of God. But here he can do nothing but be acted upon. So he is passively being obedient. And what does that mean? Well, we see his humiliation, his willingness to be humiliated. We see his patience. We see his meekness. We see his self-control. We see his forbearance. We see this strength of love that is greater than all the violence around him. Because you need to remember, just a few verses back, he said to Peter, "You know, I can call down 12 legions of angels and stop this thing at any time if I want to." You do know that. That's true here too. At any time this could stop. But Jesus endures it. And he chooses and allows this to happen. And then he'll go with these men who fear and hate him to stand before Pilate. And that's what we mean by the passion. It is the long-suffering love of God, which is where you're getting really to the heart of God. This willingness to endure because you love the other so. He loves these people who hate him. So that you have, when you put these two things together, an ugly story. It's the worst of religion. I've used this quote so many times, but it's so good. Blaise Pascal: men never do evil so completely and cheerfully as when they do it from religious conviction. Please don't think that just applies to Islamic extremists. Don't think it just applies to them and not to us. They never do it. We never do it so happily as when we think we have God on our side. These men think they have God on their side. They think this is absolutely righteous behavior. Then we also need to see that as we come to this story, I was hesitant to even preach this tonight because I thought I couldn't endure what Christ did. But I'll never lose the fact that at the center of our faith is a belief in the cross. Paul said, "I must preach the cross of Christ." Because as much as we'd like to make the gospel relevant, and as much as we'd like to make it upbeat and positive and best life now and all that stuff, it just doesn't exist, friends. That's not the message of the cross. Frederica Matthews Green, the Orthodox wonderful lady, says, "Giving offense turns out to be a pretty consistent part of the Christian story. It begins with God in a diaper and proceeds to God on a cross, beaten and bleeding and shamed. It's a brutal story, one that isn't easy to take, because it shows us quite clearly the worst of humanity and how even our best things can be distorted and corrupted. But it also, thanks be to God, shows us the greatness of God's faithfulness, the absolute goodness of God's love, the incredible extent of the divine compassion. It shows us God's goodness in the midst of our hatred. It shows us God's love. That's why we come to the cross again and again. We're astounded by the fact that Jesus loves us so much. He says, "This is my body broken for you. This is my blood shed for you. Do this in remembrance of me. For I am not dead, I have risen." And then we move into Easter, because the cross is just a tragedy without Easter. Keep that in mind. If there's no resurrection, the cross is just a tragedy and nothing more. Shows what happens when you try to live a good life. But because of Easter, it is a victory. So that is trial part one on Sunday. And I don't do this often, but it's just right and appropriate. This is Palm Sunday. We'll do trial part two, and we'll move into that segment where now the political powers through Pilate and the crowd get involved, and we see ultimately how this trial plays out in two parts. Next Wednesday, we do not meet because Thursday is Maundy Thursday. Thank you for all of those who've been here as part of your Lenten devotion. I appreciate your attendance and your participation. If you choose, and those of you who are regulars, when we come back, we'll start right up with Peter's threefold denial, Judas hanging, and so forth, because those are where the story goes next. Peter denies, Judas hangs himself, and then we get to the Pilate's trial. But we're skipping those and moving right to the trial. So let me offer a word of prayer, then I'll invite the worship team up here.